What was gonna be my banter for this week, for this episode?
I love how you want to prepare the jokes beforehand.
It's not so much preparing the jokes, it's just like...
Prepare your stand-up material.
It's a very cold Friday. I think it's getting colder.
Yeah.
So, and it's getting darker really quickly.
Yeah, typical of October. And speaking of like darkness, sorry, maybe I shouldn't have said darkness, but in the UK,
yeah,
it's actually Black History Month,
yeah,
which we have not spoken about. True. On this podcast. Sorry, I thought darkness October. Ooh,
yeah.
So, and you know what's interesting about this month, or what I've realized, is that I think generally this month has been far more muted and quiet in regards to Black History mm-hmm. Month in the UK, and I'm interested as to why that is, because last year, I don't know if it's because last year was, you know, there was a lot of like Black Lives Matter protests, yeah, and everything, so perhaps October, Black History Month, felt more, it felt like there was more activity.
Yeah, because even the Black Lives Matter thing was all, like, instigated from America, wasn't it? Mm. So that sort of rolled over to the UK and every other part of the world, and that's probably why we had so much going on. But I don't really recall, like, any other Black History Month being anything exciting in the... Because it's usually in schools. What I remember is, you know, your school might probably have a Black History event. Actually, no, when I... companies also have a lot of events around Black History Month.
Do they?
Some company. Well, okay, this was something I wanted to talk about in our banter, right? Last week? Anyway, in the last 2 weeks, in this month, my company, I think there's this like national pledge thing around Black History Month where there's a company, there's a movement or an organization, and one of their activity is trying to get companies to pledge to how they're going to improve the plight of like their Black and their diverse employees and all that stuff.
The plight.
So like the diversity and inclusion team in my workplace, you're obviously on Teams. They started typing these messages about, oh, the big promise, that's actually what it's called. Mm. And so, you know, they try to get the senior leadership teams to make like big promises for how what they're going to do to contribute to encouraging diversity and inclusion and all that stuff. Mm. So the big promise this time has been around like Black History and So one of the promises is I promise, so a senior leadership person will say, I promise to reflect equity in pay and recognition and reward. So that's been like one promise that all of them have actually been saying. I'm like, okay, when it comes to the end of the year, right, and I have to do my end of year report, I'm hoping that this is all going to reflect in practical terms.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is, one of my colleagues, like an older, he should be retired basically, but they keep retaining him for all this other project. He said to me, I went into the office this week and he said to me, Laura, can I ask you a question? I said, yeah. He said, so he opened up the Teams page and then he read that line about the big promise. I promise to reflect pay equity in pay. He's like, what does that mean? You know, what do you think of that? Mm-hmm. And I said, to be honest, I don't really know. I don't know what it means. I guess I said, what I see it as is when I think of gender inequality, mm-hmm. then think about racial inequality.
Yeah.
So it's about if you recognize the fact that people can be discriminated against because of their gender, then I see it as the bank or the company recognizing that employees can be discriminated against based on their race, and therefore that might reflect in how they've been treated and all that stuff. But I said, how is it gonna work practically? How are you Because you have to acknowledge then that actually, no, you've been discriminating against people. Because otherwise, if it's a case of everyone gets reward based on their performances, then there really shouldn't be any of this, I promise to. Because I'm just wondering, how does it make the other people feel? Because it now feels like, for me reading that, I felt quite uncomfortable. Because I'm like, it makes me feel like I'm getting some sort of special treatment. Like, oh, I promise to reward you and pay you and all this stuff just because it's diversity and inclusion or Black History Month. And yeah, it's something I've been reflecting, and I'm very skeptical about these things. And I think really? I said to myself 2 years ago, I'm no longer going to any of these Black History Company events where they're telling you how to be Black and powerful and Black and excellent.
That is so interesting. You know, there was a time when I thought like that and I felt uncomfortable because I felt as though it was maybe tokenistic, or, you know, not. It was just something to do to be seen, to be fair. But there's part of me, though, that also thinks it is necessary because, there's the argument that it's better than nothing. And I think the work of inclusion is a long and a messy one. So there are attempts being made to address discriminations that we have faced. I think the point you made, though, about actually acknowledging where in the workplace you've done wrong is really important. Because there's no use saying we're going to do this to help improve your experience, but we're actually not going to talk about the thing that was ruining your experience in the first place. Yeah, and for a lot of us, acknowledgement of acknowledgement of the discriminations against us is really where healing begins. Like actually seeing us and recognizing who we are, recognizing our humanity and the dignity that we should be treated with. That's the first place, really.
I just think, like, just do the do and stop talking. Like, this conversation has been going on for so long. And I'm just like, you know what you need to do. Just do it. I don't need you to be sending me big promises and telling me you're going to do this, you're going to do that. I'm more about the action. Do it. If you know what's right to do, just do it.
Yeah.
And oftentimes when, especially like obviously in companies, there's always a lot of things that are not, you know, you see things and you're like, oh, that could be better. And people could be this, you know, the leadership team could take this into a bit more consideration and all that stuff. But I think at the point where I am at the moment, I feel like I'm tired of lip service. And until I actually start to see you doing the work, until I start to see people getting promoted, because you know that they're actually doing work, until I know that I'm not afraid of talking about my pay, I'm getting a pay rise. And you know, even the whole thing about having to ask for a pay rise, even in the first place, just irks me. I'm just like, why do I need to ask for it? You should see how hard I'm working and offer me a pay rise.
Yeah.
I feel like it's so disingenuous, the whole thing. That you have to, at the end of the year, you do your appraisal and then they say, oh, you've gone above and beyond. Well done. You know, you get a pat on the back. And in some companies, you get promotion. You might get promoted. But oftentimes, it's almost like you always have to fight for it.
Well, I mean, with any company, though, they're about, you know, maximizing profits.
And... But then that's the point. It's like, you're not really interested by my life.
Yeah, but I think that's when you get into tensions. I mean, I could go on, you know, the tensions between this capitalist society and then your humanity and what you need as a human being to thrive.
Therefore, all these big promises are pointless.
No, let's not be despondent.
Anyway, speaking of Black History Month, and speaking of Nigerian history, let's actually get to the point.
Yeah. Hi everyone, I'm Evelyn, by the way.
And I'm Lara. I think we should be able to tell our voices by now. I hope so.
But we may have some new listeners. This is the Once Upon a Niger podcast. We're glad you are here.
The number one history podcast.
Number one.
Sorry, my earrings just fell off.
It happens. The excitement. It's just... So we've been speaking about Black history.
Yeah.
And in our previous episodes, we spoke about Nigeria's independence and the impact of that and the legacy of that. But we want to talk about another historical moment, actually, in modern Nigerian history, and that is the End SARS movement. So when this recording is coming out, it would have marked a year since a major incident during the End SARS movement in October last year, which was the Lekki Tollgate massacre. And we thought it was only right that we talk about it on the podcast and use it as a moment to record and reflect
on this
important moment in the country's history. This is actually an artifact that people are going to look back on and listen and try and understand and analyze what the impact and the legacy was of the End SARS movement.
Definitely. And I think also it's probably a good time to just think, a year on, how far have we gone?
Mm-hmm.
Looking back, what happened, what progress has been made, if any at all. and just see what the future holds, really.
And the
people who were sort of notable figures during the protest, where are they now? What's happening? So, but we've said End SARS. What is SARS? SARS as in SARS, and that stands for the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, which is like a special police unit in Nigeria. And I was just looking into like how they were set up in the first place. What was the motivation for setting them up? What was their agenda, the objective, or they, you know, what were they set out to do? And they were created, the unit was created in 1992, and they were created specifically to tackle armed robbery in Lagos, because at the time there was a lot of, like, you know, violent crimes. There was a lot of robbery where actually I remember, I was not that old, but I was old enough to remember, like, people receiving letters in their homes that were coming to rob you on this day. That's how brave.
Wow.
That's how brave those armed robbers were. And I just used to hear stories.
The one time people are given notice and we'll be here on time to rob you.
Yeah. And they're like, we're coming at this time. And sometimes, some of them even make special requests, like, make this kind of food for us.
You're joking.
I'm telling you, one time, right, a family member was telling us of another family that we know of quite well, and they went to rob their house, and, you know, they had to, like, make pounded jam, make gusi. The robbers came, they ate to their satisfaction, you know, just the effrontery, like, just the audacity.
Yeah.
And it was just rampant and it was happening all the time. So and I think a lot of Nigerians probably will have this story of, yeah, being robbed and just come and they go. So the SARS team was created. And oftentimes they were also, like, meant to be undercover.
Mm-hmm.
They were meant to be, like, undercover policing. So they usually would be, like, in plain clothes, in plain vehicles. And they didn't really carry arms back in the day. And the main objective for them was to facilitate, like, the successful arrest of criminals and make sure that they're convicted, etc. But as you can imagine, over time, the movement, it moved from them just being in Lagos, then to other states in Nigeria. And gradually, eventually corruption entered the matter for many reasons that actually was part of the request that the End SARS people were asking for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these officers, some of them, most of them, it would seem, eventually, you know, started making it as an opportunity to extort people, and they were going beyond their mandate
If anything, they were becoming the people that they were supposed to be capturing.
Yeah.
Which is really just a wicked type of irony.
Yeah.
So, yes, they were, you know, like, they're a notorious police unit. And in most recent years, they've been targeting young people with... and discriminating against them, targeting them because of the devices that they may own, and, you know, this perception that young people, especially young men, are committing fraud. So they'll see a young man with an iPhone or a laptop or something that is just represents modern times and technology.
Yeah.
And use it as an excuse.
Yeah.
To not only take those items, force them to an ATM to take out money, etc. And often these young people are brutalized, harassed, and killed.
Yeah.
And it has gone to the point where young people of Nigeria have said enough.
Yeah. And many times over the years they've said enough. At different points over the last 10, 20 years, they've said enough, and the government has, and they've asked for reform, and the government has said, okay, we're going to do something about it. And I believe it was 2015 or something where they actually disbarred the SARS unit, but it then just came back.
Yeah.
And so, you know, just to kind of like paint an even more picture of, you know, what you were saying about the young men and the sort of targets that they would have. So it's, the phone, the dressing,
mm-hmm.
how dare you dress in baggy jeans, or, you know, how dare you have dreadlocks, and how dare you tint your hair, and how dare you have an iPhone, how dare you wear designer clothes, how dare you drive a nice car. And it almost became like they were penalizing the young Nigerian men, mostly the guys, penalizing them just for having nice things and sometimes for working hard. And even when they're saying, so I have family members in Nigeria, guys who, during the NSARS protest, I was speaking to them and I was saying, have you ever experienced this? And one of them was actually saying to me, this happened all the time. He's experienced it like a lot of times, where if you say you want to, you're looking out for like fraudsters and stuff like that, your priority should be, when you seize their phone, what are you looking for in the phone? But they take your phone and then they go through your contacts, they go through your messages, they log into your banking app, they check your bank, they check your balance, then they take you to an ATM point, and they get you to withdraw money. Or even sometimes they drive you all the way to their station in some faraway place, and they just leave you there in the hope that eventually you're going to want to pay them anyway for them to release you. So it's like, are you actually investigating a crime here, or are you just looking to get paid for nothing?
Yeah. It's been a pretty dire situation.
Yeah.
Last year is when the movement, the End SARS movement, gained a resurgence. But it's something that had started, actually, the hashtag End SARS had actually started like in 2017. And it's usually off the back of a death of somebody that is like caught, that has caught wind on Twitter especially. But in October last year, it became known again and had a resurgence because of a killing that happened in the Delta state in Nigeria. And so I think we've spoken a lot and given our listeners
a
background and picture of this. But I think what is really interesting and unique about the End SARS movement is it's been a really... It's put a lot of like hope in me. You know, I've spoken on the podcast before about like rugged optimism, and I think that End SARS movement is just the perfect picture.
I think we need to put on the t-shirt, optimism.
Rugged optimism. Hashtag. Yeah. Because, you know, the young people of, well, people of Nigeria, Nigerians are a resilient people, and that is evidenced by the youth of the country and seeing everybody like come together. The images that I was seeing online, I was so moved by it, and that everybody was getting involved. So they were, you know, I mean, there were activists who have been doing this for a long time. There were musicians, comedians, but it was like everybody was involved.
Yeah.
From the more quote unquote privileged to those who are lower on the totem pole, so to speak.
Yeah.
They were all out in the streets.
It was a unifying event. Mm. It really unified people across all social strata. Like, like you said, both young and old, poor and rich, across different countries as well. Because, mm-hmm. you know, it started, I remember just seeing the protest on Instagram, starting there. And just like yourself, being here in London and just feeling the... I felt it in a different way.
Mm.
I felt the pain. I felt the vision. Like if you can feel a vision, I felt what they were really, you know, looking to do. And it was a moment of hope.
Mm.
Like that moment of this could be it.
Mm.
This could be the moment where we can achieve something by standing up to the leaders,
mm.
making our request known and not backing down,
mm.
and not even having a betrayer in our midst. Like, because many people felt like, well, how long is it gonna last? Yeah. That was number one question. People didn't think it was gonna last long. People didn't think it was going to have much of an effect.
Mm-hmm.
But then we can come on to talk about, you know, how long it lasted,
mm.
what impact it had. Well, what was some of the things they were demanding during the protest?
So alongside the hashtag hashtag #NSARS, there was another hashtag 5 for 5, and the mm-hmm. demands for that during this resurgence of the movement was the release of like all protesters.
Yeah.
Justice for victims of police brutality and compensation to the families, setting up a body to oversee the investigation and prosecution of those police officers, and then the psychological
evaluation,
which is really...
It's just really important.
Yeah, it's really, really important, of those police officers, well, the SARS unit. And then another key thing, as with so many things in life, money.
Yeah.
Increase the salary of the police officers, and that's important because the reason for that is to de-incentivize.
Yeah,
I think that's the word.
De-incentivize the need for them to extort ordinary mm-hmm. Nigerians, because during the protest they were showing some of the living conditions of these officers, and just even generally speaking of, you know, their life during service and after service, and many of them can't even say. That's why they see a young guy on the street with an iPhone and like, I can't even afford an iPhone, you know. They see you wearing nice clothes and driving a nice car, and it shouldn't be like that. But there's no way you should be serving the government, serving the people, and be so underpaid that you can't even sustain your own livelihood, you know? And clearly, if that is a motivation or an incentive for what they're doing, then it's like, what's the solution? You need to pay them more so that they don't be on the streets looking rugged and looking homeless and looking rough. And even like the police stations are not well funded. The barracks, the police barracks are really...
just awful conditions.
Awful conditions, you know? So, and I feel like it goes to show the heart of the people when they were doing this protest, because they could have just asked for everything for themselves and not really cared about, you know, what the police officers were going through. But it goes to show the holistic approach to which that these people had towards what they were trying to achieve, because they knew that if we're ever going to be safe on the streets of Nigeria, and if we're ever going to have the confidence in our police to uphold the rule of law and to actually do what is right, they need to be in a position that they're not going to be tempted to do all those things, because you just have to appeal to their humanity.
Mm-hmm.
When you get pushed to a corner, you never really know what you're capable of.
Mm.
And when you live long enough in a country where people are so desensitized to just... Imagine just being in a company where... I mean, this is far from the example, but back in the days when, you know, the whole scandal of MPs' expenses came up and MPs were claiming ridiculous expenses for
This is in the UK.
In the UK, yeah. Members of Parliament.
So that kind of corruption also happens here, by the way.
Exactly. So members of Parliament were claiming expenses for ridiculous things. And you think it was just happening. People were doing it. Now, of course, you can't really say what they're doing because they don't get paid well. But the point is, because it's become just a part and parcel of the practices, they just get desensitized to what it is they're actually claiming for. So you go and buy coffee, you're claiming it. You go and do this, you're claiming it, to the point that you now start to do the bigger things, and you're claiming expenses for them when you shouldn't, which is stealing, really.
Yeah.
But, you know, so yeah, the same thing, you're part of the police force, somebody comes to you for a case and says, help me to solve this case, they pay you. Everybody's doing it. Even your boss is doing it.
Mm.
The lines are blurred. There's nobody to check you anymore.
Yeah.
You don't even realise what you're doing is wrong.
Yeah. There's a lot of things to pick up on in what you've just said as well. I think there's one thing I want to touch upon in light of what we were saying in regards to Black Lives Matter and the protests going on, and that notion of hope and feeling as though something could change. I think it's interesting to look at the End SARS movement of October 2020 in light of the summer of protests we had, of Black Lives Matter.
Around the world.
Because last year, like, Black Lives Matter also didn't start last year.
Yeah.
You know, it started many, many years before that. Yeah. But there is something... I was going to say in the source. So I was like, that's not...
Something in the water across the ocean.
Yeah, something in the water, something in the air, in the ether that caught a light. And obviously we're still in a pandemic, but at that time, you know, it was the height of the pandemic where there was a lot of fear. And I think a lot of people, you know, threw caution to the wind, right? So... there are a few things for the context around that. You have COVID-19, where, you know, people are scared to get sick. And so a lot of people were thinking, well, there's a pandemic going on, and then I'm facing police brutality in the US context. A lot of Black people were like, we're already dealing with so much. Forget this pandemic. We're tired,
yeah.
Right? And then I think that sentiment is what a lot of people have felt in different areas of their life, where they're sort of like, actually, like, life in their eyes is short,
yeah,
and I don't have time to, you know, all the things I was scared to do, go out to the street and protesting about these things, actually just do it now, because life is coming at all of us really quickly. And then, you know, the power of, like, American narrative of prominence in the media, I think, has like shifted, and a lot of people, America's very good at, like, telling their story, and people are around the world sympathizing or empathizing with the myth of of America. And I think there is something that kind of, like, rubbed off on other places around the world, especially for Black people, and the question of police brutality. I don't want to say that what happened in... I think there is a slight connection in the question around police brutality and Black people.
Yeah.
That is something that should be explored.
Definitely. And was it like a catalyst? Because I feel like the whole American thing, it was a catalyst. It sort of triggered people across the pond in different ways. Mm-hmm. And I think, like you were saying about the pandemic, I think for the first time in centuries, I mean, I don't know when the last time the whole world was in a pandemic and everybody was just in their house and you were in lockdown and you could actually think. It was a moment of reflection. It was sober. Mm. You know, everybody was... for the, because sometimes in the day-to-day living, you don't have the time, you don't have the luxury of time to ponder. And you know things are happening. You know life is happening at you left, right and centre. But you haven't got that time to just ponder and reflect and try to do something about it. And I think for the first time last year in the pandemic, the whole world had time. Mm. We had time to pause. We had time to reflect. People had time to go out to protest. We had time to be online, even though people are online all the time. But it was almost like it was different. You had time to kind of like pay attention to all the things that are happening, and they're not just news bites. They're not just news sound bites. That's it. You were actually like soaking these things in. And I remember a friend of mine calling me and crying because she was fit, and she lives in the UK, and George Floyd was in America, and she felt it. A lot of people were feeling it so deeply, and I think that probably the ripple.
And that sentiment, because I think there's probably a recognition of what has happened in America and just the utter frustration.
Yeah.
And then for the Nigerian context, seeing this happen so often, and because it's Nigeria, it doesn't get the same prominence on like global media that like American stories do, but it's very much the same thing of seeing young people dying at the hands of police. That was just like enough, like the straw that broke the camel's back. I think it was a very unique 2020 was it like
a it was unique, a unique year.
So I think I just wanted to like highlight that, because I think there are some interesting connections there, and also an interesting, you know, discussion about like police brutality for Black people and what that means in different countries. Because in the US or the UK, often it's the police are predominantly white, and you know the brutality is against like ethnic minorities are over policed.
Yeah.
Whereas police brutality in Nigeria, you know, the question of race is not really a question.
It's not a question of race.
It's not a question of race. So then, you know, there have been lots of discussions online about, you know, the role of police, and and there have been even like hashtags of defund the
police.
The police and all that, which I think is a conversation for another.
I think I agree with you in the sense that it's not anything to look at in isolation, like even the whole NSARS protest. It's nothing to look at in isolation. And I remember the irony of, obviously, George Floyd happened before NSARS and, you know, the whole debacle. And I remember listening to this chat show that I watch in Nigeria, talking about how different leaders of the world were responding to the injustice, you know, because America prides itself on being the leader of, you know, of all the other countries and all this stuff. And so now it's almost like having your children tell you off, like, what are you doing? So, to some degree, I'm sure many other countries have left America behind. China has no business with America, to some degree. But it's almost like you feel like you have the position to say something and to like speak to power in this other country. But I remember like when the president of Nigeria, I'm not quite sure what he said, but it's like, you can't talk.
Yeah. You have no leg to stand on. You have no legitimacy. You don't command respect.
And this was even before NSARS.
And it's not even necessarily about commanding respect. People, unfortunately, just don't respect you. Because
you need to take out the log in your own eye before you take out the speck in someone else's, isn't it? And it's like, you need to put your own house in order first before you talk about anyone else's. And that was pretty much the position. But I think I think it was really important for us to kind of like just speak around the whole protest in Nigeria, what happened, what it was about. And I guess sort of just kind of rounding up this episode is looking at the way the people galvanized themselves, the organization behind it. Was there anything about it that you thought was remarkable or that you thought was interesting in any way?
I think it was really interesting that the protest didn't have a leader. And I think that's something that's become more common with protests these days. I think protests of the past, you know, you or movements of the past, you know, you had these charismatic leaders mm-hmm. that everybody got behind and could look up to.
Mm-hmm.
And I still think you need that to a degree. But I think in particular, what was very interesting about the NSARS movement, there were no leaders. And it was a very simple message. The message of the NSARS movement was, like, literally in the name, end SARS, shut it down, end police brutality. And I think that what's beautiful about there not being a leader, which can often sound scary, you know, like, we don't have a leader, how is this going to move forward? But what was beautiful about that actually was that, for me, it's like everybody is a leader, everybody is taking charge and enacting and embodying their personal sovereignty. If you could,
we're all leaders in this country.
Yeah. And I think that's the attitude. I think that is an attitude that needs to be taken, especially for a nation like Nigeria. I think, yeah, so that's one thing that I found very interesting.
Yeah. Somebody else might disagree with you, because I remember having this conversation with a couple of friends last year, and they were of the view that actually maybe they did need a leader, because one of the holes that the government dug into the whole argument and into the whole protest was, we don't know who to go to talk to. You know, we need somebody, we can't, who are we going to start negotiating with? So you're telling us, do this five things, you've given us this five demands, this five requests, we can't do them all in one day. It's going to need time. So we need somebody at the forefront of this whole business
okay.
to negotiate with.
Okay, let me comment.
So I'm saying to you, Evelyn, how can we all be leaders? Your body has only one head.
Okay, let me, you know what I find interesting about that is, earlier on in this episode, we were talking about the frustration we have in the workplace where people are just chatting and coming up with all these, just talking about making changes, but they know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
They know the changes that they need to make, right? So in the same way, I think maybe we have got distracted by the fact that the government has said, oh, you don't have a leader, so we don't know, like, who to talk to. And it's like, these people know right from wrong.
Mm-hmm.
These people know, yeah, what they need to do to, they know the right thing to do. They're choosing wickedness.
But they will tell you that it's not like they don't know what the right thing to do is. They're saying, we need to strategize. We need to talk about how we're going to do it. How are we going to move from A to B, B to C, C to D, until we get to Z?
They are the so-called experts in government. They are supposed to be governing. They actually have the expertise there.
But they want to have their Nelson Mandela. They want to have their they want to have their Martin Luther, Martin Luther King.
Yeah, let's not get those two mixed up.
I always do that. When I said Martin Luther, I was like, no. You know, they want to have their own Malcolm X and all this other, you know, whatever it is. But I do think, though, to an extent, I appreciate the whole, and I guess even that's what makes the whole protest in the Nigerian context a bit different. Because in other parts of the world, we must acknowledge the reason why there was an hesitation to have leadership,
mm-hmm.
because that was also from a place of distrust
mm.
of, we want transparency. we don't want you to have anybody in your pocket.
Mm-hmm.
You go behind closed doors, you close the doors, you have your conversation. The person comes back out and tells us it's Chinese whispers. We don't, you know, it's a different story. Mm. And so we don't want to be deceived. And therefore, so let's all hear what you've got to say. I can appreciate that as the motivation, mm-hmm. for lack of leadership. But I think to an extent, the way people galvanized, it was almost like there were sub-leadership groups.
Mm.
Because even till today, despite the fact that people would say, I wasn't a leader, when you start to think of names of the protest,
mm.
there are certain people that come to mind.
Uh-huh, that's what I'm saying.
There are certain people that came, there are certain people that, whether they intended it or not, they were just the face and the voice, or their voices were more...
Yeah, prominent. And I think that's part of what I mean by, you know, you have a group of leaders. Those leaders, quote unquote, will naturally emerge. I think we don't need to artificially put somebody at the front and say XYZ is going to be the leader. It's when you feel, and many Nigerians have personally, and especially during the protests last October, felt it was their own personal responsibility to be out in the street and hold this police unit and government to an extent to mm-hmm. account.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose in our next episode, we can talk about who some of those people were and how they went about it. I mean, and it was so interesting seeing the people that the government were even speaking to. There was a time, I think, Davido, they called Davido to
and
speak. And I said, listen, I'm appreciative of the effort. But it's more than shouting that we need. you know.
Because you can't just be an accidental leader. You need to be a leader with purpose. Because it's one thing to find yourself in that position of leadership because for whatever reason your voice is louder or your face is more attractive for whoever. But you need to also be in tune and be ready to accept that position and to be ready to say, these are my people. We're all fighting for the same cause and I will never betray them. There needs to be a bit more allegiance for somebody to be an intentional leader, as opposed to we were all in this together and then I was just handpicked because you know, whatever. And I think that was probably part of the arguments that they wanted, I guess not an artificial leader, but they wanted people to kind of come together and say, okay, we've selected a committee, because Nigeria loves committee,
mm-hmm.
that would never achieve anything, just be setting up committees upon committees, doing nothing. They want you to set up a committee that they can then come to and say, okay, we've spoken to your committee, now you go back to your people and tell them this is what we've said. But you know,
I feel as though that is their own strategy to delay meeting the demands of the people. So we don't have a leader, so we need to set up a committee, we need to do X. No, I think it's, you know, just keeping your eyes wide open. I think I'm just, there are so many brilliant Nigerian people,
mm-hmm.
and I think this, no one is excuse the right word, I'm not sure, but this argument or reasoning that you don't have a leader.
Yeah.
It was like even the five demands that were requested, or so it's a demand is a demand.
Demand, yeah.
Have those been met?
Yeah.
It was written down. It was shared on social
media.
And
they were quite simple demands as well. And they were quite
simple demands, and have they been met? Pause.
Yeah. So I guess we can, you know, later on talk about the effectiveness of protests generally, and even just reflecting a year later, what progress has been made, mm-hmm. looking at how the protest was able to cut across other side of the world, and you know, people were, you know, the British Parliament was discussing the NSARS, and
yeah, there's a whole thing around that that we can get into,
you know. And then it's also, then next episode will also give us an opportunity to also just look at other people in the past in Nigeria's history, the kind of activism that they've shown and what they fought for. And I guess really looking at, because they paved the way, didn't they? You know, you in your history, you have people who have done similar things. Protests have been happening all the time, for different reasons, for various reasons. We've spoken before about it. So I think, yeah, it would be good for us to kind of delve into that a little bit more. But this has been a good one, just reflecting back. Because it's easy to really forget, like, you know. And that's the thing about history. If you don't, because I wonder, in 20 years' time, or even in 10 years' time, the kids who were born in the pandemic last year, quite a lot of them were, in 10 years or in 15 years' time, are they even going to remember? Are they going to be taught that such an event happened? Will it have any significance in 10, 15 years' time? Will this event be something in history that we're always going to look back on and have something to say about it? And, you know, has it been the sort of catalyst for change that Nigerians intended it to be?
Find out in next episode of Once Upon a Niger.
So guys, thank you for tuning into our conversation. Hope you've learned a thing or two.
Yes, so see you next time. I'm Evelyn.
And I'm Lara.
Bye. Bye.